Lunch with Leon.
Probably imagine that having electric buses driving around Rutlandshire northwest is somehow helping the polar bears on their icebergs, but in fact, it's not doing that.
Hello and welcome to Lunch with Leon. We are back to buses this episode, and my special guest is none other than David Leader. David has had an illustrious career from West Midlands to being a main board director at First Group, which of course is where we work together. Now he is chief executive of Transport Investment Limited, a group of very experienced transport professionals, giving data-driven analysis of the risks and opportunities in the wider transport market. And as we recorded this, we were in the midst of those incredible swings in the reported plans for the impending budget, as the Chancellor seeks to deal with a poor economy, a major gap between government spend and earnings, and a revolt from the backbenches. I told David I thought this was all rather gloomy.
I think it is very gloomy, Leon. And I think that we should say, you know, in starting off, this is not the homework of the current government. This problem has been brewing up for about 20 years. So the way I would think about this is that in 1997, the last time Labour majority government was elected, a debt as a percentage of GDP was about 30%. And when they were elected in 2024, it was almost 100%. Now, why has that number gone up from, you know, 30% roughly to 95%? There are really three reasons that have moved the number by this massive amount. The first one was that the Blair and Brown government planned to increase public spending. That's what they were elected to do and in what they did. Then we had, of course, the banking crisis, which required the banks to be bailed out. Now, of course, that usually gets into a debate about the bankers, but the reason that the banks had to be bailed out is that every business, every household borrows money from banks, so they had to be bailed out or the economy would have entirely gone bankrupt. So that's the second reason. And then the third reason was COVID. And if we were doing this at a presentation and I could show you a graph, I mean, I can show you a graph that shows that COVID was by order of magnitude the same as the Second World War. So that's why we're in this, that's why we're in this big hole. Now, on the subject of like borrowing, to kind of link this back to transport, Leon, because the numbers are so extraordinary, I find them hard to understand. We all know what the Elizabeth line looks like and feels like, and that cost in the order of about £19 billion. So I think that gives you a kind of flavour of the numbers. We know, we can all understand that Elizabeth line is a very big piece of spending. Now, in September this year, the government borrowed over £20 billion in a month. So they borrowed the entire cost of the Elizabeth line in 1 month, and they spent 2/3 of that sum on debt interest on the government debt. Year to date, they've borrowed almost £110 billion in extra debt. And, you know, the simple way of understanding this is if the government spends 100 each year, the tax income is only 95. So I think that's the context in which transport sits. But I think you can see if you're borrowing the entire cost of the Elizabeth line in a month, there is a significant problem that we should all be concerned about.
And on that basis, transport, of course, only sits behind one or two other very important areas like health and education and defence and so on. So the maximum that transport is ever going to get is going to be lagging behind some of those other essentials, isn't it?
Well, it does sit behind, but it sits a long way behind, Leon. So let's just imagine, you know, the government spending is a cake. About 50% of that spending goes on health, social security and pensions. And they have been rising quite rapidly. There's been an enormous increase in the number of people who are unemployed but on permanent sickness. And obviously there's an endless demand for good and other reasons to spend more money on the NHS, you know, new technology, the consequences of COVID and so on. So half of the cake is going on social spending. Now, transport is about 5% of total spending. Defence is about 5%. But I mentioned these eye-watering borrowing numbers. Well, 9% of the annual spending is going on debt interest. And 0% is going on debt repayment. So, you know, the problem the government has got is that although taxes are an 80-year high and are clearly going to go up significantly in the next budget, as they did in the last budget, they're not actually bringing in enough to pay the bills. And that's why they're borrowing more and more money. So there are two risks to transport, and particularly local transport. The first risk is the being swamped risk. This is like dear old Neil Kinnock, you remember, walking on Brighton Beach with Glenys and the waves overwhelming him. And so there's that kind of problem. A small increase in social spending will swamp the transport spending. The second, let's talk about the transport budget for a while. What do they spend the money on transport? About 60%, 3% out of the 5% that they spend on transport is going on rail. And there are clearly major problems within the railway budget of rising costs, fairly feeble revenue. Passengers have come back since COVID, but revenue remains feeble. And in the background, we have, of course, the problem of High Speed 2, for which there is no budget that I'm aware of to complete the building. So High Speed 2 is now so enormous, that is another threat to the budget. So there are threats within the transport world, but that clearly the bigger threat is that public spending, particularly on social spending, is now so high that the transport budget, the defence budget, etc., becomes squeezed.
Indeed, and some of this is also a feature of people living longer, the cost of care. The one that I've always been interested in, you would have thought 40-odd years after Margaret Thatcher and everybody becoming a homeowner, the trickle-down effect of equity in property would have reached the current generation and it should now be easier to get on the housing market. But in fact, even though that inheritance would be diluted by multiple children and the fact that people live longer, it's probably fair to say as a generalisation now, isn't it, that it's harder to get on the housing market for a number of reasons, and the equity trickle-down that should have happened by now is evaporating because of the people who should have died living longer. And not only are they living longer, they incur more cost, including the cost of care. And so therefore, people are inheriting much less than they might have expected to. And I can think of very many people where what should have been inherited roughly equaled the cost of care in later life.
Correct. I mean, this is something that we experienced in my family when my father, who lived to 96, the last few years, his health and his mobility disappeared. But there are several things about tax that are relevant to that as well. I mean, you're absolutely right. People are living longer. If you think about the way that tax works and the way that you can gift intergenerational wealth, the government, and I mean, when I say the government, I don't just mean this government. I mean previous governments really since 1997, all of the governments since 1997. They have created an incentive in which it's better for people to stay in their houses and then pass the houses down on death. So they stay in large houses because that's more tax efficient. Stamp duty is an enormous tax disincentive for people to move. And also, I mean, if you get to, as my father did, you know, 80 or 90, do you want to move? You could make the technocratic argument that it's better to move to a smaller property. But the real world argument that's understood by everyone in Wetherspoons, but not by the PPE class, is that actually you stay in your house partly because you like the neighbours. And in the case of my father, I mean, his life was saved by the neighbours. When he became ill at 89, it was because he knew the neighbours. They all had keys and so on. If he'd been living in some small flat in Eastbourne or something, which may have seemed a good idea at the time, he wouldn't have had those social connections. So I think you're absolutely right. And the social care is also another issue for transport, because that is putting pressure on local government budgets. A second social change that's causing problems in local transport budgets is the huge growth in special needs transport. So whilst it's true that overall public spending is at sort of an 80-year high, the changes in the economy mean that certain areas of public spending have been subject to pressure. But overall public spending hasn't now gone down. Now, you said, how bad could this be? I think the answer is it could be very bad. Because the sequence of events is there's a budget at the end of November. The debt markets will take a view on whether the government has a plan or not. If they think that the plan isn't very good, they will either say, we don't want to buy UK debt. We won't buy any more of this debt that they're issuing every month unless you increase the interest rate. So that 9% of public spending goes up to a bigger number. If there's a so-called buyer's strike, which is like the worst case scenario, that's the 1976 scenario. So everyone talks about the IMF bailout in 1976, and that's obviously a close analogy. But the really painful part of the IMF bailout wasn't the loan, it was the conditions attached to the loan. So if you look at a graph of public spending over the last 80 years, most people imagine that public spending was cut by Mrs. Thatcher, the milk snatcher, when she took office in 1979. But actually, the brutal reduction in public spending occurred under Dennis Healey as Chancellor in 1976, because he came back from the IMF with an obligation to make cuts. Now, again, let's link this back to transport world. At the moment, and per your comments, Leon, a lot of people, when they talk about austerity or cuts, they really mean cuts in the rate of growth. But we could be in a position in the spring of next year, going into the summer of next year, ironically 50 years exactly from the Dennis Healey crisis, that Rachel Reeves or her successor, and that may be the case why nobody wants to be her successor. Lots of people don't like Rachel Reeves, but I'm not hearing of a lot of people wanting to be Chancellor at the moment. But she may then have to impose actual cuts. Now, what would they look like in transport? This would mean ringing up Sadiq Khan and telling him that we have to cut your budget, not cut the rate of growth in the budget. You would have to put the fares up significantly. We would have to cancel any thoughts of DLR extensions and Bakerloo line extensions. We'd have to abandon or postpone new trains for the Bakerloo line. Now, analogies with the 1970s, why is there no underground railway in central Manchester? Because it was cut in the 1976 plan. The Tyne and Wear Metro and the Argyle line, they went ahead because they were at the digging hole stage. So I think that's the kind of scenario one can imagine playing out in the early to middle part of next year, where if you think about how they're doing this, there's two budgets a year now. The autumn budget, which now is the Christmas budget, that's supposedly about raising the funding. And the summer budget is about spending the lolly, as they say in the world of organised crime. And the problem may be there is no lolly. And I think a particular risk is that projects which were announced in summer 2025 that are not actually signed, sealed and delivered, they may be cancelled. So I think that's the kind of bad case scenario. That's not the worst case scenario. We might want to talk about that, but that's a bad case scenario.
That's bad enough. The one I've always thought that transport has done badly is that, of course, although it's a spending department, many of the benefits of the spending that takes place in transport accrues to somebody else. So yes. It accrues to health and it accrues to education. It accrues to business and so on. Transport has always been held out as a pure spending department, but it's not a spending department like defence is, where, of course, the spending isn't very high until you actually start firing the missiles and then it does get expensive. But in fact, pretty well all the money that transport spends has a benefit. And it comes back, but it doesn't come back to transport. It comes back to somewhere else. And we've never made the mathematical, we've never been able to quantify the value as to why the spending in transport is good, because it's simply gobbled up in social care and education, health and all sorts of other places.
Yes, and I think there are some topics which are well rehearsed. I mean, I certainly know they go back to the 1980s, where you could reduce the transport spending in aggregate and improve the benefits. So this is the old topic of, you know, we've got the Sunshine minibus, we've got the school minibus, we've got the NHS minibuses. And we've recently done an exercise where we looked at the entire UK passenger carrying vehicle fleet. And the numbers are absolutely mind-boggling. There are far more vehicles than people realise. And this is evidence of the huge duplication of vehicle fleets for, let's call them kind of broadly social use, school minibuses, local authority minibuses, all of that could be done much better. That is being prevented by institutional complications. Essentially, people have different responsibilities, different funding streams. So that's an area where you could save some money. But I think the problem in relation to the overall public spending situation is that social spending is now so big that we can all agree that High Speed 2, you know, is an absolute disaster. And as transport people, I think we should be ashamed of what's been going on there. It's deeply wasteful. But actually, High Speed 2, etc., barely contribute to the problem. Now, I think one area where I think there's a bit of optimism here is that there is quite a lot of private capital available. And we've advised quite a number of funds over the last few years who are essentially energy transition funds, and they are looking to invest in things like fleets of electric buses and all the associated equipment, even the energy generation, the additional renewables required, etc. So there are those pots of money. You've got to put yourself in the shoes of the local authorities. Now, in the summer 2025 spending round, the current government, having already given Manchester in the order of £1 billion for bus reform, also said we would pay for another, I think, 1,000 electric buses. And obviously, it's much better to have 1,000 free vehicles than have 1,000 vehicles where you have to pay. And outside of Manchester, the effect of the Zebra funding is that on average, they've been 75% funded by the private sector and 25% by the DfT. That's the simple maths. This 70% of the excess makes it all complicated. But basically, the equipment you need doubles in value. If you had 100 with diesels, you need 200 with electric, if you include all of the other equipment. And if you average out the maths, DfT put up 25%, private sector 75%. That's obviously not as good as the DfT saying, we'll just pay for the whole shebang. So I think that some of the spending decisions the government have made since they were elected, giving large pay increases, for example, to railway employees, they have actually added to the problem. Because if I was a local authority, I would say, I would like what Andy's just had. I would like some free electric buses, please. If I was a trade union representative, I would say, well, you know, we've just given some of the railway staff, if you annualise it, three times the inflation target. So I would like three times the inflation target. So again, this is a classic 1970s type prices and incomes inflation problem. But there is private sector funding out there. It is inevitably more expensive than free money. But before you kind of move on to that topic, you've got to be, I think, clearly told by the government, you won't get any free money. And I think that they will have to do that in the next 6 months. Now, my worst case scenario, that you kind of come into my worst case scenario at that point, Leon, because I think my worst case scenario is the government tries to do that. And there is then revolution from the backbenchers. And it, we've had a lot of that since they were elected, pushback on social reforms and so on.
Indeed, it is said, isn't it, that when you have such a large majority, your biggest opposition is behind you, not in front of you.
And that this government has clearly had that. And this morning's headlines, I mean, we're recording on Friday. This morning's headline is that they have, you know, abandoned the kite flying on income tax increases. That may or may not be the case. But they're clearly under enormous pressure from the backbenchers, who it seems to me basically want to spend more money on almost everything and increase taxes on almost everything that affects the highest, say, 50% income deciles. And the problem is those people are already extremely highly taxed in the UK. In fact, taxation of the lower income percentiles in the UK is actually rather low by European standards. In other words, the average person in places like France and Denmark pays a lot more tax than they do in the UK. Now, I'm not going to win any medals, I mean, for saying that, but most people don't want to pay more tax. So we understand why we are where we are. So the very worst case scenario is a version of what's going on in France. In France at the moment, they've also had the same kind of problem. Their debt is even higher. They've been spending more than the tax take, I think, every year since 1974, and they cannot approve a budget. So for the last almost 2 years, they've been unable to pass a budget in France. But of course, under the UK convention, if you can't pass a budget, the government has to resign and call a general election. Now, they don't have to do that. There's no law that says that. But that's what's always happened in the past. And I think that is the kind of territory that we could be in. It's kind of where Labour was in the 1970s. But you will remember, Leon, that period from 1976 to 1979 literally involved people being taken out of hospitals and brought to the House of Commons to vote with drips on their wheelchairs, because they didn't have a 200-seat majority. They had a minus nine or something, and they were depending on the Liberals. So they had to get every vote through, and it was literally the case that very ill people were being brought in to vote to get budget measures through. So that's the kind of, you know, worst case scenario. I think in that kind of scenario, they really would be having trouble with the bond markets, not least because France and Italy are in big problems. And we can imagine plenty of other things that could go wrong. I mean, there's a war going on in Europe. There's a war going on in the Middle East. So there are plenty of known problems that could get worse. I hope this is cheering you up, Leon.
It's how I like to spend a wet Friday, always, David, absolutely. And I was just really reflecting on that because there is some feeling, I certainly feel whenever I listen to the government, that somehow they believe that governments can drive business growth. But actually, governments don't drive growth. They create conditions and business creates growth. And the evidence this week is that growth is being stifled, certainly on the back of the 2% national insurance employers hike in the last budget. And it's very clear that small family businesses generally, including the ones we know in transport, are selling up. And they're selling up for a number of reasons, that business prospects look poor. And of course, in transport, we have this net zero thing, whereby many, many of the SMEs involved in transport don't really want to start dealing with the risk that comes with converting to battery electric or hydrogen or whatever. To some extent, this race to net zero is a version of what you and I learned in economics, because eventually what gets you out of a recession is obsolescence. We've got a special sort of obsolescence. The diesel fleet is not obsolete. It's just that everybody's determined to move to battery electric and possibly to hydrogen. And therefore, that's forcing investment where it otherwise would be withheld. It would be put back. We're getting this forced obsolescence on us, which is helping the manufacturing and it's helping the supply chain and so on. But I think I'm quoting you when I say that does mean that people are spending £500,000 on a brand new shiny electric double-decker bus to travel at walking speed in some of our cities.
Yes. Well, so there's about 10 things there, Leon. As always, you think very quickly. I mean, I would say, first of all, as our mutual friend Mike Weston would say, this investment in electric vehicles is really an investment in local air quality. It's got an absolutely de minimis effect on any kind of global warming, although lots of people who are not McKinsey-type people probably imagine that having electric buses driving around Rutlandshire northwest is somehow helping the polar bears on their icebergs. But in fact, then it's not doing that. So there's a lot of investment going into buses, but it isn't really investment in what I would call bus passengers. So you're absolutely right. The only known game changer for buses is to make the buses go faster. Because if the buses go faster, the costs go down and the revenue and the patronage go up. London at the moment is proving, almost like a kind of laboratory experiment, that if you spend enormous amounts of money, and the spending in London is in the order of 900 million to a billion a year of subsidy, and rising quite fast for various reasons, the subsidy number, that even with extremely favourable demographics, the patronage will go down. So that's kind of like point one. On the SMEs topic, the government, again, I think inadvertently is doing several things to make life difficult for them. One of them is, again, a tax change. We keep hearing about the farmer tax, but that, of course, applies to every kind of private business. So they are now faced with more or less the impossibility of passing generational wealth. I mean, you could assume, let's give the government credit for being, you know, very thoughtful on this. We could assume that they've actually deliberately decided to kind of tax intergenerational wealth. Now, we know in our industry, many of the best bus companies are the surviving family-owned companies. They take a long-term view. They do not worry about the next quarter's earnings update. They focus on cash flow. They have strong links into their local communities. So I actually am an advocate of having more of those kind of companies. We have to find a way of encouraging people to stay in business and join the business. It may be that they are better placed to fit into the new regulatory world. Third point is about how that could link to electric vehicles. Well, this is where grants, but also enabling companies of the kind of Zenobi variety. And it was companies that come along and say, we will convert your depot to electric. We will worry about the battery recycling. They have a role to play in helping SMEs. SMEs, by the way, include the remaining municipals. They basically include everyone who hasn't got hundreds and hundreds of vehicles, who, whether they like it or not, are now in the electric vehicle business. So I think that the government needs to think more clearly about what it wants. Does it want private capital? Does it want the capital of families? And family-owned businesses, if you think of how this could play out, the owner of the company would die. They would be faced with enormous inheritance tax. The next person in the family could be run over by one of the buses the following week. They would have to pay inheritance tax again. So it doesn't actually pass the cash flow test. So I'm not at all clear why they thought this was a good idea. it will have implications far beyond farmers and far beyond bus companies.
And so that brings us to the thing that you and I have been talking about, and you in particular have said at several events that we've been to over the last year or so, which is, it seems to me, and I think it seems to you, that the combination of the cost of franchising across the country and the cost of going to zero emission, the money will run out before the job is done.
That is the risk. I mean, in the summer 2025 announcement, the government has effectively provided funding to maybe four or five more city regions to do what Manchester has done. As we've previously said in this conversation, the risk is that that money could be chopped in the extreme case that we described, where they have to make actual cuts in the budget to placate the bond markets. Now, it's probably worth dwelling on, like, where is the money gone in Manchester, so that we kind of understand the mathematics of that. Boris Johnson, as far as I can see, gave Andy Burnham in the order of £1 billion. So where has that £1 billion gone to for buses? 50 million has gone in advisory fees, and 200 million has gone in buying assets. So what assets did they buy? Basically depots and some of the buses, and a lot of the, you know, depot equipment and so on. So that is a transfer of cash and capital actually to the private sector. I think people think that's like investing in the public sector, but that's essentially buying up assets that in some cases have been around in Manchester for over 100 years. So that's where like 250 million of the billion has gone. We think that the running cost of the network has roughly doubled. So it was probably running at about 100 million a year. So that's concessionary fares, running the bus stations and so on. And it appears to be now running at about 200 million a year, the like-for-like spending. Why has that number gone up? Multiple reasons: underlying cost inflation that's affected all bus companies, but also they've specified various things. There are more buses in the network to make it more reliable. They've got different IT. There's a whole load of reasons. The bid costs have to be reflected in the running costs. So all the operators' bid costs have to be in there, including the costs of the losing bids. Because if you only charge the winning bids, you'll eventually run out of money. So that number is running at 200 million, but probably trending towards 300 million. Why is it going up? Well, they intend to run more services. So Manchester is in a good position at the moment because of the generosity of two people, essentially: Boris Johnson, who gave them the first billion, and Keir Starmer, who gave them the, or is giving them the money for the additional electric vehicles. And the electric vehicles, the free electric vehicles, of course, will reduce the operating cost by about 10%. But that's only because the government has picked up that cost. Now, given Andy Burnham's appearance at the Labour Party conference, if I was Keir Starmer, I would have withdrawn my offer of free buses. But I think politically they feel they can't do that. If you're a regular local authority and you're not as lucky as Manchester has been, Manchester's been very expert really for almost 40 years. If we look at this, goes back really to the late 1980s with the beginning of the tram network. Manchester has been incredibly effective at making its case compared to equivalent local authorities. So the problem will be for everyone else, if there isn't large amounts of DfT grant, how are you going to pay for it? Are you prepared to raise taxes locally to an equivalent sum? London is now doing that. I mean, London is now paying for a lot of the day-to-day grants with local taxes that were previously DfT grants.
Indeed.
It's not gone away.
No. So, as you know, at the Bus Centre of Excellence conference that we had in Portsmouth, I challenged the Metro mayors who were there about local fundraising. They were all clear that devolved fiscal fundraising powers were crucial. But that rather assumes the public likes giving money to the mayor's office more than they like giving money to the chancellor. And I'm not entirely sure, as a taxpayer, I draw much distinction, because either form of local fundraising comes out of my pocket, and the more money I give to them is less money I can spend on myself. Is this fiscal devolution really a runner, or is it just the government doing what governments have done now successively over many years, which is to unload the problem to the local authority or to the metro mayors and say, it's all yours, get on with it, but only giving them 70% of the funding to do so?
So If they try and raise the money locally, you get into another problem, which is the inequality of incomes across the UK. So the UK looks like an averagely prosperous country when you look at the aggregate data. So people always say things like we're the fifth richest country in the world and so on. That is on a total GDP basis, but not on a GDP per capita basis. So on a GDP per capita basis, we're probably the 15th or 20th richest country in the world. Plenty of people are catching up and overtaking us. So the Czech Republic, Poland and so on, it's not at all inconceivable that they will be on average richer than we are. But let's just stick with the UK. The problem in the UK is that most of the wealth and most of the tax income is in about four places. And they are London in the southeast, Bristol, possibly Harrogate and Edinburgh. And so if you say, well, I'm going to increase taxes in Humberside or in Merseyside or whatever, you would be levying those taxes on different people who are, on average, poorer people. I mean, in London is unusual. It has lots and lots of very rich people and also a substantial number of very poor people who are essentially being supported on various types of benefits, including subsidised housing. So if you're the metro mayor of somewhere in the north where average incomes are quite low, that is a very different proposition than the government's current proposition in the national budget, which is to say that I think everyone is above 45,000 a year, they've decided is the rich. So they're going to try and concentrate even more taxes on people at the highest income percentiles. And there aren't many of those people in places like Sheffield and Liverpool. So I think the pushback will be absolutely enormous. Mm. And the difficulty that people would have paying these higher taxes would be substantial.
So, David, as we wrap up, here's a really unfair question, really. If you were a Metro mayor, what would you be hoping for in the summer?
Well, if I had received a letter in the summer of 2025 promising me a good spending settlement, I would be moving, to use Keir Starmer's phrase, at pace, to actually contractualise that spending and get on with it quickly as possible so that it's harder for my settlement to be cancelled. If I was one of the majority of local authorities that didn't receive a very generous settlement, I would be using the new powers that I've got under the recently passed buses legislation to wrangle the private sector, my existing operators and potentially different operators, to invest in my network, because that money, if I could secure it, would not be subject to sort of emergency spending cuts that might occur during 2026. So there are some positive things that people can be doing, and it's the winner is, as always, the best organised local authorities and the best organised operators.
Amazing. Thank you. Look, David, this has been fascinating, and you and I have had some conversations on the margins of events recently, which we thought would be interesting to broadcast more widely. David, of course, you can find David at transportinvestments.co.uk, where, David, I think you're happy to hear from people, especially if they're looking for your help and your wise counsel and your advice and your analysis of what's happening in the whole transport sector. So thank you very much indeed. This has been Lunch with Leon, produced in association with Passenger Transport magazine. Please go to Passenger Transport and take a look in the fortnightly publication that brings you all the news from the world of transport. David and I have been talking about transport generally. We didn't quite even get onto rail properly, but we can do that on another occasion. But just for now, a big thank you to my guest, David Leader.
Thanks, Leon.
Electric dreams to hydrogen streams. We're mapping futures, chasing schemes, guests bring visions bold and bright, turning transit into lunch with Leon. Take a seat where innovation meets the street. From policy to passengers' view, we're moving the world along with you. Batteries charged and tracks alive. Progress served with every line.